you who've done a lot of Holden sessions will have sympathy with me. This is my first one. I visited Holden once 20 years ago. When I start, this is extraneous. And then we just came back, so this is our first time here, and of course my first time as a teacher. So I'm still getting used to the Holden mood. And now we will begin. I wondered all day yesterday why people did that. It's for the tape. My name is John Lundblad. My title, or my position, as it's known, is the English-speaking pastor at the Church of the Redeemer in the Old City of Jerusalem. Church of the Redeemer is a multilingual and multi-congregational church in the middle of the Old City. You all will have seen it on your television screens one time or another, in that it's a tall tower right in the middle of the city behind all the television reporters who are broadcasting from the Mount of Olives. We're here on home leave and had this opportunity of coming to Holden. And today, have us down as our topic, religions of the Middle East, even more, be talking more about religion in the Middle East. It's actually the first of what might be two sessions, which can be seen as running together. Today, I want to talk some about what religions are in the Middle East, and more specifically, the style of religious life in the Middle East. Because I think that's one of the very confusing aspects for us in terms of what we hear from news and what we experience. Tomorrow morning, I'll be talking more specifically about Islam and the new movements within Islam. I think most of us first began to realize that something was changing in that aspect of the religious world from the Iranian Revolution and the attack on the United States Embassy in Iran. We began to learn something about Islamic fundamentalism. We'll be talking some more about that tomorrow. A couple of things just to define some terms first. I want to spend some time talking first about religion itself, and then about the three primary religions, and then still leave enough time for questions and comments and discussion within the group. By Middle East, which is a fairly recent term, primarily comes from the World War II period, we're talking about that area, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the Gulf states, Iraq, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, the West Bank. That area of the world is what we commonly mean as the Middle East, sometimes also known as the Arab world or the Arab East. So that's our geographical area. The religions are pretty simple. We think about it, and you've seen one phrase countless times, the home of the three great monotheistic religions of the world, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Islam might be a new term to some of you. It's what, as most of us were growing up, was always referred to as Mohammedanism. That's a very negative term to Muslims. And it's a term that really we should learn not to use. If you see it anymore, or if you've been in the habit of using it, it's a very negative term, and it's seen as being insulting because a Muslim does not feel that he worships Muhammad in any way. So we'll be talking about Islam and Muslims. Before we get in, I wanted to add just one other comment, and that is that if you're at all confused about the Middle East, about religions, about politics, about anything, you're right. And you should not feel bad about being confused. Because if you're not confused, you're not understanding the situation properly. And if you can hold diametrically opposed positions and agree that they're both true and both valid, but mutually contradictory, you're not able to handle the situation, because the Middle East is made up of propositions like that. The people who are not confused only do so by limiting their area of concern to a very small area, or by eliminating all sorts of other concerns and propositions. So confusion is our starting point, and it will probably only get worse as time goes on. So don't feel bad about it. In fact, if you're not confused, then you should start to worry, because then you're leaving some things out. I put a couple of things up on the board, if you noticed as you came in. We'll go through them one by one, as kind of some key phrases for understanding religion in the Middle East. The first of them is, you can't be a nothing. All of us have the experience sometimes of responding to surveys. And we know that in government surveys, for example, you can no longer be asked your race, your religion, etc. But occasionally you get somebody coming around doing a community census, and they will ask, what church do you go to? And you can put down Roman Catholic, Lutheran, Episcopalian, Assembly of God, whatever you want, or you can say nothing, no affiliation. That's a valid answer in our part of the world. In the Middle East, that answer does not exist, because everybody has to be something. And that's the idea of community, that religion in the Middle East and in other parts of the world would be true also in Africa and parts of Asia. Religion is as much a community concern as it is a personal concern, sometimes even more a community concern. You belong to a community, to the Muslim community, to the Jewish community, to the Christian community, and to any one of the other numerous minority communities. You're born into it. It's not even a matter of your own choice. You're born a Christian, you're born a Muslim, you're born a Jew. It's listed on your identity card. In Israel and on the West Bank, the area that we live in, but also true in every other country in the Middle East, everybody has an identity card, which lists your name, and then your nationality, your citizenship, and your religion. Nationality and citizenship are different things. Citizenship would be, for the citizens, would be Israeli, but then they can be, by nationality, either Jewish or Arab. And by religion, then Jewish, Christian, or Muslim. The High Court in Israel in a decision a year ago, in response to one appeal by one family who wanted to be listed as nothing religiously, determined that it was contrary to the national policy of Israel to let there be nothing as a viable religious identification. And that would be equally true in all the other countries. You're something whether you believe or not. Your own personal faith in God is irrelevant at this point. You are a Muslim, or a Jew, or a Christian. Whether you believe or not, you can be an agnostic Jew, you can be an atheist Christian, you can be a totally non-practicing Muslim, and you remain a Jew, a Christian, or a Muslim. You can change it under certain circumstances, and depending upon the countries. In some countries of the Middle East, for a Muslim to change his religious affiliation is a capital offense. Capital in meaning capital punishment offense. In other countries, a Christian can marry a Muslim, but a Muslim may not marry a Christian, depending on the particular countries. So religion becomes an identification point. It means that in the majority of countries, there is no cross marriage. You don't have secular marriage, you only have religious marriage. And so when I have a wedding, even for foreigners, I can only marry Christian and Christian. And I fill out a certificate of a Christian marriage. There's also a certificate of Jewish marriage and a certificate of Muslim or Islamic marriage, but there's no certificate for a secular marriage. There are no justices of the peace. That's the first idea of religion. Now, that's very different from us, and I think you probably caught up with it, is that in the United States, we are a secular country. So is Canada. So is most of Western Europe, even though they may have state churches or state religions, they are secular countries. You don't have to be religious. If you want a secular marriage, you can go to a court. If you want to, in Germany, not pay your church taxes, you file your petition, and you no longer pay your church taxes. And in the United States and Canada, if you don't want to go to church, nobody cares. And nobody may ask you on an application form for a job whether or not you are religious. That's what we mean by being a secular nation. The government takes no official part in religious life. Which takes us to that second statement, that there's no First Amendment. And I hope I got my amendments correct. In that there's, the amendment says, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of a religion. That's impossible in the Middle East as well, because every nation is a religious nation. Egypt is an Islamic nation. So is Saudi Arabia and Jordan and Iraq and Iran and Syria. Israel is officially a Jewish nation. Lebanon is officially a majority Christian nation. We'll come back to Lebanon a little later. It means that in each of the nations of the Middle East, you begin with a religious basis, not a secular basis to the nation, which means that the conflict over prayer in public schools is impossible, because in the public schools throughout the Middle East, religion is a part of the curriculum. It's automatic. In fact, there are final exams in all the public schools on your particular religion. If you were Muslim, you take the Muslim track. Christian, you take the Christian track. But it's a part of your curriculum. It also means that basic law is not, as in our tradition, British common law or secular law. It's religious law. In Israel, for example, if the law does not cover, well, in the United States and in Canada or in Great Britain, if a judge has a case and the law does not exactly fit the case, he is trained, God willing, to use the whole tradition of British common law as the heritage. What makes sense according to our tradition of law? That's secular law. In the Middle East, in Israel, it's the whole tradition of rabbinic interpretation is the basis of the law. If the civil law doesn't cover the situation, you go back to the rabbis. And what is the Jewish tradition? In the Muslim countries, if the law does not cover it, you go back to the religious law. Islamic law is called the Sharia. You go back to the Sharia, Islamic law, and say, how does it cover it? In Egypt, in Saudi Arabia, in the other countries, that there's also a statute that says that the legislature shall pass no law which contradicts Islamic tradition. So, for example, you cannot make you cannot make alcohol a legal commodity in Saudi Arabia. Because it's forbidden under the Quran. Therefore, the Saudi royal family could not legally import alcohol. In fact, there's an interesting case recently, they caught one ring that was smuggling in cases of scotch. And they were all convicted not on smuggling, but on bringing in alcohol. Smuggling is not an offense under Islamic law. And it's just not mentioned. It's not an offense under Christian or Jewish law either. Yeah, you can play with it. But the handling of alcoholic beverages is an offense. And so they were convicted not because they were smuggling and evading the tax, but because they were handling alcohol, which is forbidden. So that's the second difference, is that we're dealing not with a secular world, but a basically religious world. The kind of world that we in the West left behind 200 to 300 years ago. And in fact, we were not even sure. The closest we have in the United States would have been the Mormon tradition in Utah in the 19th century, up until World War I. But even that has disappeared by now. We just have decided to be a secular country. The third thing, not all Christians believe in Jesus. Here's where we come back to Lebanon. Because often, as you've read in the newspapers and you've heard on the television about the so-called Christian forces in Lebanon who are fighting the Palestinians, who are fighting the Syrians, who are fighting the rightist forces, and who are fighting the Marxist forces. It's a civil war with about five or six different sides, And if you don't have a scorecard, you're really lost. Now, if you break, it sounds simple. All the Christians are in one corner and all the Palestinians are in another corner and all the Syrians are in a third corner. The problem is the Palestinians are 10% Christian and much of Palestinian leadership is Christian. The Christian forces are at least half Muslim. And the Syrian forces, Syria as a nation has at least 12% Christians in the country. A good number of their forces are also Christian. And the leadership is all from a minor Islamic sect that doesn't trust the majority of Muslims. And in the middle, you get the Lebanese, who are divided into about five different sides, and you have a mixture of Christians and Muslims on both sides. To define one group as Christian is to define it by a particular leadership. So Bashir Jamal is a Christian. Therefore, his forces are called Christians, even though they're close to half Muslim. And that's where this term, not all Christians believe in Jesus, comes in. So it means when you see a tagline like, the Christian forces attacked a Palestinian camp, don't think that it's a religious war. Because it's a political war with a political basis. At the same time, to contradict what I just said, it very much is a religious war because you have this division of everybody into religious communities that take on political aspects. So on the one hand, yes, there's a religious identification to every war because you cannot separate politics and religion in the Middle East. If I were to put up a fourth proposition or change the last one, I'd say the idea of the separation of church and state in the Middle East makes no sense whatsoever because the two are so intertwined. We have either politicized religion or divinized politics. Divinized? However you pronounce it. The two are so closely intertwined that you cannot separate them out. So what it means is that if you begin to seek a political explanation, you end up with religion. And if you try to come in from the religious angle, you end up with politics. And that's what I meant at the beginning by saying the confusion only gets worse. So it means that as you approach the questions or the conflicts, remember that they cannot be approached as we would approach even the conflict in Northern Ireland or the conflicts in the Western world. It's a different stance. So beware the easy titles and remember that everybody is more confusing than they ever seem. That's a bit about religion itself in the Middle East. If you have some questions on that, we'll come back to it after we look at each one of the religions. In terms of the religions, we'll talk about three primary religions: Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Now, there are also minor groups that are scattered around. Groups like the Baha'i, the Druze, the Samaritans. You all thought the Samaritans died off of the New Testament. They're still there. The Alawites, the Yazidis, who are my favorite group because they're the old Satan worshippers who believe that Satan got a bad name and that he's really the favored son of God and all the... You know, everybody else has given him a bad name, but he really is good. And they're a minor group hidden in Iran. You get a lot of different, and also remainders of Zoroastrians, who are still scattered around. But we'll just look at the three major ones. First of all, Judaism. Judaism, of course, we know from our heritage, can trace back through Moses to Abraham. Judaism, of course, is found primarily in Israel. There are approximately a little more than 12 million Jews throughout the world today. About 3 million of them, 3.2 million to be more precise, live in Israel. Another 3 million live in New York City. That's true. Another 3 million are scattered in the rest of the United States, meaning that there are some 6 million Jews in North America. Half the world's Jewish population lives in North America. 3 million, approximately, in Israel, another 3 million scattered throughout the rest of the world. They're scattered in many different countries from in all the continents of the world, but they're also scattered throughout the Middle East. There are Jews in Syria, there are Jews in Iraq, there's a very small community in Iran, there's a Jewish community as far east as India, there's a Jewish community in Egypt, and some others scattered across North Africa. Those communities in the other countries of the Middle East were much larger before 1948. But with the entry of Judaism as a political reality, that is, as a state in 1948, and the resultant emigration of the vast majority of Jews from Iraq, from Yemen, from Egypt, from elsewhere to Israel, those are all declining communities. But they're still there, and they have survived the last 30 years. So Jews are not just in Israel. Israel is a Jewish state. And as I mentioned before, that means that it works on Judaism as what we would call a state religion. There it means that synagogues are maintained by the states, rabbis receive their salaries from the state, there's a ministry of religious affairs, along with a ministry of defense, and a ministry of welfare, and a ministry of foreign affairs. And it means that you have many laws which are religiously based. The buses don't run on Saturday, Shabbat. Everything is closed down on Saturday. You cannot sell pork unless you have a pork-eating population, that is Christians, in the vicinity. That's one of the names for Christians, by the way, in Arabic, is the pork eaters, because neither Muslims nor Jews eat pork. So it's one of the negative names of Christians there. The Judaism, though, that is true in the Middle East, and in the rest of the world for that matter, is not the Judaism that we know from the Bible. There's been 2,000 years of development between the Pharisees and Sadducees and the Essenes that we read of in the Gospels, and what could be called the Pharisaic Judaism, or the rabbinic Pharisaism of today. In that after the destruction of the temple in the year 70, the Sadducees, who compromised with Rome, were discredited. The Essenes, who were the radicals out in the wilderness, had been destroyed. The revolutionaries, a third wing, were all in prison, and the only survivors were the Pharisees. And they developed the trend of Judaism after the temple, without sacrifices, without a temple, with a new tradition of the law. Came at the time also of the rise of the rabbis. So what we have today is not the Judaism of Jesus' day. And don't ever think that Jews today are like the ones that Jesus was talking with in the temple. It's rabbinic Pharisaism, who based themselves on the law as it's been interpreted by the rabbis for the last 2,000 years. So we have not just Torah, the first five books, but Talmud, the whole commentary. It's a growing body of commentary that is there. Judaism, especially in the last 50 years, and particularly since 1948, is also a political reality with the rise of the modern state of Israel. The question that has come, especially since 1948, is what is a Jew? Let's stop for just a minute. Can someone give me a quick answer? What is a Jew?
Somebody who thinks he's a Jew.
Somebody who thinks he's a Jew. That's Martin Buber. That's good. What else?
Somebody who's born a Jew.
Somebody who's born a Jew. Think anybody, anything else?
One who thinks that the Messiah is still to come.
Okay. What else?
Descendant of Abraham.
The descendant of Abraham. Okay. A race?
Yeah.
What else?
The Muslims are descendants of Abraham.
Yeah, I was about to say that if we come down to the last two items, someone could say all of the above, and that'd be true, and someone else could say none of the above. What do you think?
Well,
It's also true. Because, yeah, Muslims and Christians also claim to be descendants of Abraham. You know, I am a child of Abraham. One who is waiting for the Messiah to come, well, there are a lot of Christians who will talk that way too. You know, we may talk about it coming again. We may add the little adverb, but we're not that different there. A race, some have said that. It's a problem. In fact, within Israel, that's a political question. Who is a Jew? The closest the modern state of Israel has come to answering that question is what is called the Law of Return, which was established by the Knesset, the parliament, to determine after 1948 who could enter the country as an immigrant and receive citizenship. And so they said there are two classes of people who can automatically come in and claim citizenship as Jews in the modern state of Israel. One are those who have a Jewish mother, and two, those who have converted to Judaism according to halakha, that is Jewish religious law. The rabbis were asked, why? Now, I don't mean this facetiously, I'm being attacked as making this up, but this really is a rabbinic question. Why, if you have a Jewish mother? Why not a Jewish father?
Could be a question of paternity.
Exactly. The rabbi said, you always know who the mother is. That was a real question that came out of World War II. Because in the concentration camps, there were certain instances where pregnant women were exempted from certain duty. And rabbis in the camps said that it was possible for a Jewish woman to get pregnant out of wedlock if it meant the saving of Jewish lives. Because a basic rule in Torah, or in Halakha, is that this saving of life transcends all other commandments. So any descendant of a Jewish mother is automatically a Jew. Anybody who has converted is automatically a Jew. The first one, anyone who thinks he is a Jew, that's the response of the philosopher Martin Buber. And there are many people who believe that too. That a Jew is one who says, you know, Ani Yehud, you know, I am a Jew. That is not acceptable at this point. Within Israel, it's still a question. Who is a Jew? Because in Israel, going back to our first comment, you can't be a nothing, we do have atheist Jews. A good example of an agnostic Jew was Golda Meir, who believed that maybe there was a God, but it didn't make any difference. And that was when the State of Israel was founded and the Declaration of Independence was being drafted, there was a mixture of groups. The religious forces, the nationalist forces, and all the others were drafting it, and they came to the preamble, and the religious forces said, we want to say something about the work of God in establishing the State of Israel. And the secular forces who had come out of the ghettos and the concentration camps said, no. The only ones who have had anything to do with the establishment of the State of Israel is us. God died somewhere in the camps. in the Auschwitz. Said, we will not allow anybody to say that Israel is coming from divine hands. So they compromised, and they said the Rock of Israel. And the Jewish the religious forces said that the Rock of Israel means the God of Israel. The secular forces said the Rock of Israel is the land and the people of Israel. Now, both of them consider themselves Jews. So you have Jews by religion, you have Jews by national heritage, you have Jews by patriotism, you have Jews who light a candle on a Passover because they want their kids to have something. And you have Jews who say, well, you got to be something, so, you know, why not a Jew? And another one who told me, said, I'm a Jew because the rest of the world says I'm a Jew, and for no other reason. Now, that means that there's no common definition as to what is a Jew, except coming back that there are people who define themselves as Jews beyond a religious definition. This is the point I want to get across, is that there are many Jews in the world who say that to be a Jew is not just a religious definition, but it's national, it's historical, it's philosophical, it's all sorts of things, and it's an antagonistic definition in one aspect, in that to an extent it is Jewishness by definition from outside. There are some within Israel who also are saying, a very small group, who say that they would rather not be called Jews, they want to be called simply Israelis and leave it behind. Okay, we'll come back to that in a bit, because I think they probably have some questions on that. In fact, I saw one over here. Yeah.
Said that they would be permitted to become Israeli if their mother was Jew. What ruler did they use to determine that? Because as you just said,
it's an old rabbinic definition of saying that if your mother was a Jew, you're a Jew. It's the same reason to say if you're in the Islamic and the Christian traditions, if your family is Christian, you're a Christian. If your family is a Muslim, you are a Muslim. It doesn't make great sense. But again, we countered by saying that we are citizens by paternity. If we have a parent who is a citizen of the United States, we can be a citizen even if we are not born in the United States. In fact, we have a lot of people in Jerusalem who are Israelis but have maintained their American citizenship, who, when they have children, bring them to the consulate to have them registered as children of Americans, to give them the option of American citizenship. So it's a holdover from ancient times of saying you are your father's son.
I was wondering what criterion they used to decide whether his mother was Jewish. That's what.
Oh.
That's what I was wondering.
If she was Jewish, she'd be Jewish either by being married to a Jewish husband or being the daughter of a Jew.
Oh, okay.
In other words, if you are part of the family of Abraham, going back to that, you are a child of Abraham. We do somewhat the same thing by saying that in baptism, you are not. One of the understandings of baptism is not just that you are in Christ, but that as you are baptized, you become a child of Abraham, a son or a daughter of Abraham. And the same thing the rabbis would say, is that in conversion, when a person is converted, he becomes or she becomes a son or a daughter of Abraham at that moment. Yeah. And we say this much the same thing. That's why we are all children of Abraham, along with Muslims and Jews. Come back to that a little more another time. We're talking about that in Romans later this week. I don't want to get off on that. That's Judaism. Christianity is scattered throughout all of the countries in the Middle East. And not because we've sent missionaries there. Christians have been in the Middle East ever since... ever since Pentecost. In that there were small bands of Christians beginning in Jerusalem to Judea, meaning Bethlehem and south, and Samaria. Remember the woman at the well? The beginning of the Christian community in Samaria, in that area, and in the Galilee. The Christians went off from there, particularly beginning from the year 70 and the attacks on or the destruction of Jerusalem, and they scattered. And with the journeys of Paul. So by the year 100, we have Christians throughout Asia Minor. And we have, even easier. Do you remember a fellow named Saul, Acts chapter 11, going up to a city? Anybody remember the city?
Damascus.
You're right. What was he going to Damascus for?
Persecute the Christians.
Right. I mean, he had a Christian community in Damascus, the capital of Syria, before Saul became Paul the Apostle. And there's still a Christian community there. And in modern Amman, and in Baghdad, and in Cairo, and Alexandria, and across North Africa, and everywhere. By the year 200, you have thriving Christian communities in all the major cities of the Middle East. In fact, Alexandria in the year 200 is the intellectual center of Christianity. Yeah.
Is this Coptic Christianity?
At that time, it's simply known as the Church. It's beginning to take on its definitions. So that by the year, we don't get the differences appearing until really after 381, in the Second Ecumenical Council, and then even more 431 and the year 451, which is a crucial date, when we had a thing called the Council of Chalcedon. If you do not have to remember the date, but it's an important one, where there was a split in the church between East and West, and we had the development of what we now call Orthodox Christianity, what we sometimes call Greek Orthodox, and the Eastern Rite, or the Monophysite, or the non-Chalcedonian churches, who are the Coptic Church, the Church of Egypt, or the Syrian Orthodox, or the Armenians, Syrian Orthodox, the Armenians, the Coptics, the Ethiopian, or the Abyssinian Church. And then you had further divisions of the Assyrians, sometimes called the Nestorian Church, farther to the east, and all sorts of other little groups. So throughout the Middle East, as they were fighting out these doctrinal battles that produced for us things like the Apostles and the Nicene Creed, we say the Nicene Creed and we look at it and say, it kind of makes sense. We forget that that was literally fought over. I mean, there were pitched battles, and it caused divisions in communities. It caused an imperial division. It was a major problem to come down and agree on that, on the how to say what we are saying. How to determine, not so much positive, but how to determine what was not the faith. There were some who said, Jesus is really God, and he's just kind of hiding in a human form, but he's really God. The humanity is bad. Well, the church said, no, Jesus is really human. And on the other side, you said, people, Jesus is kind of your Superman, right? And if you try really hard, you can be like Jesus too and become perfect. And they said, no, Jesus is unique. Jesus is divine. And then both sides said, Jesus is divine and human, half and half, right? And they said, no, it's not that either. And they said, Jesus is truly divine and he's truly human and he's all one. And it doesn't make sense, but that's what we believe. And they said, okay, you've got the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, three gods, right? Said, no, it's one God. Right. Jews said, we believe in one God too, but you've got Jesus who is truly God, and you've got the Holy Spirit who proceeds from the Father. And, so you end up things with like the Trinity, and saying it's one and three and one, and it doesn't make sense, but that's what you get. And you ended up with all of these conflicts producing churches, not so much that disagreed with one another, but that had different emphases, different approaches, and different styles. So in the Middle East, you have the Orthodox Christians, what we would call the Greek Orthodox. You have the Oriental churches, the Nestorians, the Armenians, the Copts, the Syrian Orthodox. The Syrian Orthodox, too, are my favorite church. They were the greatest missionary church in the early world. They got as far east as into India. And were it not for Genghis Khan, they probably would be a major force throughout the Eastern world today. They even have a tradition of going into China. They certainly established the first church in India, the Martoma Church, which is still alive and well. Then you have the... We kind of forget church history about the year 500, and we shift to the West. And then the Crusaders came back, thinking that they would bring Christianity back to the Middle East. They found that Christianity was there, but it was different, so they brought in Latin Christianity. So in addition to the Orthodox and the Oriental Orthodox, we have the Latin churches, Roman Catholics, and the Latin Rite. Groups like the Maronites, the Chaldean Church, and a couple of others, which are independent, or the Greek Catholics, independent churches, but recognize the primacy of the Church of Rome, or the Bishop of Rome. So they have their own liturgical tradition, but they are within the Latin ecclesia or church tradition. And then finally you have the Protestants, who began coming with Presbyterian missionaries from the United States in the early part of the 19th century, first into Turkey, then into Syria, what we now call Lebanon, and then down into Egypt. Then the Anglicans, then the Lutherans start coming about the year 1840, 1850, and then in this century you have all the other missionary groups who only further confuse the issue. So that we have Orthodox, Oriental Orthodox, the Latin churches and the Protestant churches, and they're all there, roaming around one way or another. The church in the East has a different style. It has a different history. Have any of you visited the Middle East? Somebody's got to have been in Jerusalem, right? People who come to Jerusalem look at the churches and they say, boy, it's certainly not like First Church. And we're not sure if we're sure if it's even Christian. The churches look like fortresses, but they've been fortresses at times. One example of how they're different. We build churches as places to worship, right? If you went back from Holden, back to your home congregation, and found out that while you were here, separated from the cares and worries of the world, you found out that the church had burned down, your major concern would be what? Somebody's got to be on a property committee. Did you have insurance to cover it, right? Can we rebuild? Secondly, then you get that twang like saying, oh golly, I bet all the church records were burned. We should have bought that fireproof box. But if the place is burned down, you don't worry about it because you know you can hire the community hall, worship in it, and rebuild. No problems. You can't do that in the Middle East. If a church is destroyed in a place like Egypt even, there's no guarantee that it can be rebuilt. The church also, if it's destroyed, there's no other place to worship. All of you probably come from churches where you're accustomed to let's have a picnic at the park once during the summer. We'll go to the park, we'll have our worship service by the lake, and then we'll have a picnic. You can't do that in the Middle East. Remember, it's a religious world, and none of the nations are Christian, except for Lebanon. It means you can't go to a public park and ask the secular authorities for permission to use the park, because there are no secular authorities. It's only religious. So the church building is the place where you do religion, where you have worship, where you have baptism, where you have marriage, where you have funerals, where you do everything. And it means that the place becomes far more important than place ever becomes for us. So you say, that's why they call them holy sites, right? Well, not really. We look on them as places where things happen. The church in the Middle East, the Orthodox churches says, well, yeah, it's where it happened, but what is important is not the place, the ground, but the memory. Like we do when we have communion. We do it in remembrance of. So all the churches in the Middle East built on holy sites, what we call holy sites, Church of the Nativity, Church of the Resurrection, Church of the Transfiguration, are built to proclaim a memory, not to protect a site. We want to come there and we say, golly, it's too bad it doesn't look like it did then. You know, then we could see it and measure it and study it and see whether it really is the place. For the Christians in the Middle East, whether or not it is the place isn't important. It's where you proclaim a particular memory. The resurrection, the nativity, the transfiguration, whatever. And so the church is a proclamation, and the response of a person going to one of the sites is not to study it and analyze it and understand it, but to worship. And that's why at the specific holy sites, say Church of the Resurrection or Church of the Nativity, you do not have a museum or an archaeological display or a historical explanation or a guided tour. You have a church and you have worship. Means that they approach things differently than we do. We go to see places, they go to worship. Okay. The third religion is Islam, and I just want to do this very quickly because I want to talk more about it tomorrow. Islam is the primary religious force throughout the Middle East. Even with the 10 million Christians, I meant to throw that in, there are about 10 million Christians in the Middle East. So it's not totally a small group. Under 5% of the population of the Middle East, but still they're there. Islam is about 95% of the population of the Middle East. The other 5% would be the 10 million Christians, the 3 to 4 million Jews who are in the Middle East, and all the minorities. There are about 250 million people scattered around the Middle East. Egypt accounts for a good 20% of those. Egypt has somewhere between 35 and 50 million people. Nobody wants to count. Islam has a variety of styles. It's not a monolith. It's not everybody agreeing. The Muslims in Saudi Arabia are different from the Muslims in Egypt. They're different from the ones in Iraq. And the Muslims in Iraq and the Muslims in Iran are certainly very different. They're now into new struggles. They're religion that really comes out of the 7th century, but they've been a traditional religion. And in the last 50 to 100 years, they've been faced with the challenge of modernity, the modern forces come in by the colonial powers, by secularism, as they have sent many of their young people out to study. And the traditional ways are disappearing. An example of this came from a sociologist I once listened to who talked about the mechanized Bedouin, who said that the traditional Bedouin on camel and horseback is gone. What does he ride now? A jeep, or even more commonly,
motorcycle.
No, a pickup. A pickup is good because you can carry sheep around in a pickup. You can't carry sheep around on a motorcycle. They become mechanized. They become transient. Egypt provides labor for the whole of the Arab world. So suddenly you have people who for thousands of years, John, you're exaggerating again, for hundreds of years, a family has lived in one village. And now in the 20th century, their sons are saying, I think I'll go to Saudi and work for a while and make $1,000. And he goes to Saudi and he works for a while and he comes back with $1,000. And the biggest transistor radio he can buy. That's the sign of the expatriate labor, that he comes back. But that also is a difference, because suddenly that transistor radio picks up the rest of the world and means that there are these changes coming which Islam is beginning to face, that we began to face with the scientific revolution in the 16th and 17th century. And they're facing it literally. Talked again to another person from Saudi Arabia who was at the University of Utah when I was doing some study there. And he can remember, he was there doing graduate study in nuclear physics. And he was saying he can remember when electricity came to his village. And then he saw his first electric light bulb. And he's studying nuclear physics. The knowledge jump is not hard. The gap from traditional society to modern society is immense. And that's what Islam is beginning to face now. Islam is also interesting to us because it's the other great missionary religion throughout the world. If you go into Southeast Asia, if you go into parts of China, if you go into Africa, and if you travel around the Western world, you'll find that Christianity is not the only missionary religion. Islam sees itself very much as a missionary religion. And there are many times when you will have Islamic and Christian missionaries working in the same area. It's a major challenge to us in terms of the church. This is one of the reasons why I do not feel at all reluctant to defend the missionary work of the church, because there are all sorts of other people around the world who are more than willing to tell other people about their faith. And I will not be unwilling to share the one we hold. We forget that there are other groups equally fervent. Islam and Christianity probably are most interestingly seen in Africa, because there you have a tradition of people who are making choices and who are being faced with the choice between Islam and Christianity. And Christianity doesn't always win. Islam, I hate that vocabulary. People do not always choose for Islam any more than they always choose for Christianity. There are some who choose for Christianity, some who choose for Islam, some who are choosing for the secular world and are becoming nothings. I think that's where it's a very interesting part of the world for us to watch. Islam is also very much a new political and economic force. We've lost the time when we can talk about Christianity as a political force in the world. Except as we might talk about the Western world as somehow Christian. But Israel very much sees itself as a Jewish force, and the Arab world very much sees itself as an Islamic force. And they see the gift of oil and the economic benefits which are coming from that oil power as not being the accident of history or the result of evolutionary forces which produced all that oil hidden underneath Saudi Arabia. They see it as minal law from God. It is for them and a sign that they are designed to become a major power throughout the world. Not, if not politically or militarily, certainly economically. And they see it as an extension of Islam throughout the world. And so much of that oil money is going into what are defined as Islamic ventures, Islamic banks, which do not charge interest, but which simply buy a share of whatever they're financing. Many different styles. And they're appearing around the world not just as Saudi politics, but as Islamic economics. Not just as, you know, Iraqi trading ventures, but as Islamic concerns throughout the world. And I think that's where we're facing out of the Middle East at a time when we in the West are almost completing this separation of church from state. The Middle East is coming in with a totally different way of saying there is no difference and there is no separation. And they're the new challenge for us in the West, because suddenly they're becoming the power that we in the West have to deal with. And we might be able to deal with them politically and economically and intellectually and all the other ways. I'm not quite sure anymore that we've maintained our religious resources that we can deal with the Middle East religiously. And that's a continuing question that I'm debating in my own mind as to what the Islamic and the politically Jewish challenge mean for we Christians in the West. Which takes us to about 10 minutes to 5, and I've talked too long again. But let's stop there before the bell rings for first dinner. With any questions you might have, or comments, or concerns, or anything else,
come up with. This is a technical point. I was interested, said that had it not been for Genghis Khan, the religion would have gone further east.
Yeah.
I thought it was Kublai Khan, actually. Two generations later.
That was later. Genghis Khan simply came in. And interestingly, he was faced with both Muslim and Christians who presented their case to him, and he decided, in true style, that both of them were confusing, and he decided to slaughter the lot. Had he converted one way or the other, the history of the era might have been different. Because there are literally stories, and there have been times they've been found. Some of you might have read Michener's Caravans. Remember the story of the the pillar of bodies in this one caravanserai. Literally, Genghis Khan's forces made mounds of skulls, you know, of 10,000 people at a time, just killing anybody in their path, and just not killing Christians as Christians, but killing Christians and Muslims as people, just a lawnmower across until he finally just wore out.